Say hello to a new friend on an old road. Take a two-lane trip of memories into mysteries unknown. Come along for the ride. Jim Hinckley's America. Jim Hinckley's America.
Hey, good morning, everyone. We thought we'd get a little bit of business out of the way before we get to our main program. Good morning, Keith. Of course, we had a little music here from Joe and Woody and the boys, the road crew. Always great to inspire some road trip state of mind, their music. Got some great things coming up in Tucumcari, New Mexico. That community's pulled together, the New Mexico Route 66 Association. They are working to get their neon back on after just a horrendous hailstorm. We talked to Connie Loveland recently about that endeavor, and Melissa Beasley, Mike Lee from the Fast TV Network and the Route 66 Association New Mexico pulled together and showed up this past weekend. They've had a GoFundMe fundraising for quite a little bit here. And hopefully the neon will be glowing bright once again in neon in Tucumcari very, very soon. And this is our special guest, I believe, right here, Mr. Tom Cotter.
Hi, Tom Cotter here.
How are you doing this morning, Tom?
I'm fine. Is this phone working right? I'm talking remotely through my car dashboard.
Yeah, you're fine.
All right, cool.
I am so glad you could join us this morning. I have been a fan for a very, very long time, Tom. And we briefly passed like ships of the night several years ago. You were driving a Ford Woody wagon, and we were in Atlanta, Illinois together. You'd been talking to Bill Thomas.
I did Chicago to L.A. Yeah. That's probably what it was. I did Route 66.
Yes. You know, the whole idea behind what I do, this podcast, Jim Hinckley's America, is sharing America's story in inspiring road trips. And when Steve Roth and I were talking recently about your new book, by the way, I haven't had a chance to read it all. It got here after a long delay. I just got it a few days ago, but I've been really pulled into this. America's Greatest Road Trip, Key Wested Dead Horse, 9,000 miles. That's impressive. That's a road trip.
You know, yeah, it's a road trip. It's the longest point-to-point drive you can make in North America. And, you know, the biggest problem I have is that how do I top it? Like, what's next? Because, you know, I it seems like every road trip gets longer and more dynamic and more, you know, kind of complex. Is this the last one? I don't know.
No. Once you know how it is. Good. Once you get started on these road trips, it becomes an addiction, and you'll find something else. You've done this in vintage cars and new cars, and you've had some epic adventures on the roads. I was a little envious on this. I've traveled extensively here in the 48 states in Europe, Canada, Mexico, Eastern Canada. I have never made it to Alaska. I've never done the Alcan, and it's been on my list since I was a kid.
Yeah, me too. It was once you read the book, you'll see that this was a dream of mine when I was 17 years old, that I wanted to drive an old Volkswagen Beetle up the Alcan Highway. It never happened, but, you know, it took, 50 years to make it happen.
Well, you know, we don't like to rush into things, and we get distracted with life and family and jobs. But one of the things I like about your adventures, and you really capture it well in this book, is taking time to meet with the people. That's the essence of a good road trip, is the fascinating and inspirational people that you meet along the way. And you definitely met some interesting characters here. I like the fellow who's obsessed with Volkswagens, even though he weighs 300 pounds and plays a tuba.
And he's traveling, you know, across half the United States with his elderly mother. in a Volkswagen Beetle that's packed to the gills that he just had installed air conditioning on. And the Beetle's, I forget how many miles it's got, like, you know, a million miles. You can't make that up. You know, you only are lucky enough to stumble across something like that. You know, it took us to kind of flag him down. He's driving down the road. We're driving down the road. And how do you tell a guy, you know, like, it's a two-lane road, and I wanted to kind of get next to him. Can you pull over? Can you pull over? And he's waving, high fives. No, pull over. I want to talk to you. So ultimately, he got it, and I'm so glad he did. It was pretty amazing. So, you know, he was not going quite as far as we were, but, man, he's got many more miles under his belt than I have under mine. I mean, he'll drive from Texas to Wisconsin to a polka festival so he can play his tuba.
Oh, you know, that's the essence. That's what makes these adventures so fascinating. I was just doing some research. I'll be speaking at the Miles of Possibility Conference this year. And I was my presentation is on the dawn of the Great American Road Trip. And I discovered this fascinating woman that was obsessed with motorcycles, of all things. And she talked herself into a position with Harley Davidson as a mechanic and outfitted a motorcycle with a, quote, custom sidecar for her rotund mother. And they traveled from New York to San Francisco in 1915.
Man, yeah. You know what? Yeah. No interstates, hardly any paved roads, probably no paved roads. You know, no roadmaps, no east-west route. That was right around the time the Lincoln Highway was built. Boy, that's a, you know what? We think we're heroes. I had air conditioning. I had GPS. Those people were heroes.
Yeah. Yeah. But you know, you keep your books, this book, if this does not inspire people to take a road trip, the greatest American road trip, if this is not road trip inspiring, you know, I hate to say it, but I think people have got a dead soul if they're not inspired to get out on the road, meet people, talk to people, and enjoy the trip. That one, when you mentioned the zen of not knowing where you're going, you know, just start a day and see where it leads. And like you did that morning and finding that vintage Porsche laying along out in the middle of nowhere.
Just a few miles from Mount Rushmore. You know, we had the luxury of time that we had kind of budgeted over the course of a year, put this plan together. So we drove for 4 weeks. Now, from Key West to Seattle, you could probably do that nonstop in 5 days. If you had two drivers, never stop just for gas. We did it in 4 weeks because you can't meet people if you're speeding through where they live. So we decided no interstate highways and no cities and, you know, just meet people on their own turf. People kind of live off the grid. And so I call it two-lane America. And just talk to people who are seldom talked with. Yeah. And, you know, and you find out ultimately that, you know, all the politics that are roaming around on all the media and whatever, when you get down to, you know, the United States, the interior of the United States, people are so busy getting the hay cut before the rain falls. And, you know, I got to pick my kids up from school, then I got to get back to work. And I mean, there's so, they don't have time for all the nonsense that so much of the country is involved with. And so it was really pleasant to experience what you're in the heartland of America. You know, this was it, the heartbeat of America. And it's still alive and well, I'm glad to say.
Yeah, you know, if you immerse yourself in social media, the device of politics, the news, it's very depressing. You could depress a corpse. It's gotten so bad. But once you just sit down and have coffee and you talk to people, and there's a universal commonality. I was privileged a few years ago to take a similar, shorter version of your trip through Poland, Slovakia, and the Czech Republic. Huh. And even with language barriers, you sit down and visit with people and you find ways to communicate. And it's surprising the commonality that we have. It just yeah. really is. Well, yep. You met so many interesting people on this trip. You mentioned unique Canadian humor as well.
Hey, Hoser.
my introduction to that was my obsession with the Red Green Show. His handyman talents and things have been a bad influence on me. Gosh darn it. Is the Alcan and getting up in that country, it looks like some of the roads that you got yourself into are still pretty primitive out that way.
Yeah, they are. The United States was, unless we wanted to go on dirt roads, the lower 48, we had paved roads all the way. No problem. Sometimes it was bumpy. But once you get into on the Alaska Highway, it can be, there was one place where the road had washed out, interestingly, because a beaver dam had failed, and the lake that the beaver dam had created burst and took out the Alaska Highway. And until they had it fixed, now this is in the middle of nowhere, nobody lives near here, nobody works near there, and somehow, the road crews got it fixed within 10 days. But when that beaver dam broke, if you wanted to get from point A to point B, suddenly you had to go take a 400-mile detour to get back to the Alaska Highway. Because there are mountain ranges and forests, and there's just not roadways everywhere you'd like them to be. And so when that roadway gets washed out, you have a long way to go. And then, of course, it was a little bit depressing when we went from Canada, where the roads were pretty darn okay, to Alaska. Man, once you cross into the United States again, the roads are horrible. And I'm a lifelong PR guy, and I'm thinking, wow, somebody in the state of Alaska or the United States government needs to brush up on their PR, because to many people, this is the first impression they'll ever have of the United States, going from Canada, where it's smooth, into the United States, where it's rough, real rough, like huge potholes. And then as you go further up north, as we started to go north of Fairbanks to towards Dead Horse, which is the end of the road, that's the Dalton Highway. And if you've ever seen the show on TV called Ice Road Truckers, that's the Dalton Highway. They do it in the winter, and we drove it in the summer. But that road goes from being smooth gravel to bumpy paved. And you learn that pavement is not when you've got the road frost heaves that over the winter and summer, they get cold, they get hot, that there's rain and there's snow and there's ice, that really pavement is not the best way to go, because it's permanent. And when it breaks, it's broken and it's a hard thing to fix. With a gravel road, if it has to expand and contract, and they can just grade that over and it's a good road again. So you learn these things along the way.
It's interesting, that you mentioned the beaver dam and 400-mile detour. That really is a snapshot of what travel was like 120 years ago, period, for anybody crazy enough to try to drive from coast to coast. Yeah. Alaska, the Yukon Territory, though, it's still got, from people I've talked to and reading here, it's still got that sense of adventure that we seem to be lacking a little bit. The people just live a different lifestyle.
Yep. Yeah, we've gotten pretty soft down in the lower 48, or as they say in Alaska, down in the States. Like, we're down in the States, the lower 48. But yeah, we've gotten a little bit soft. People up there, chop firewood and have to shovel snow and take their team of dogs out for exercise training runs, and it's wow, like people actually do that while we're trying to get Wi-Fi to work so we can watch ESPN football games. They're out in the backyard, the lower 40, keeping the farm running and feeding the cattle. I don't do that, but no. It sure is nice to see that there are still people that do that.
Yes, yes. I did that when I was younger. I had my John Wayne period. And when my wife and I were courting about 40-some years ago, I look back on it now, and I, I have to smile. It sounds like I'm talking about 1880, but I was still had kerosene lamps and I was driving a 46 GMC truck. And yeah, I've gotten a tad soft in my later years. There's an interesting young man. If you're not familiar with him, I'd sure like to introduce you, facilitate an introduction. He goes by the name of Tebow Barnes. Are you familiar with this young man?
Tebow. He's out of New Hampshire, right?
Yes, yes.
Yeah. He's a Model A guy. Yeah. I don't know him, but I follow him and he's pretty outrageous. Yeah.
He's right now. He just took his Model A and drove to Dearborn. And then he went to some event down in Missouri and broke a timing gear in his Model A, and he's got that patched together, and he's headed back to New Hampshire. And he apparently just recently bought a Stanley steamer, and he's been out driving that thing around.
You know, and I had, you know, he's a young guy, and he's appreciating old vehicles, and I think that's so good for America. You know, yes. We're not all digitally oriented. I'm involved with a college in Kansas called McPherson College.
Yes, yes.
And that's the only college in America and probably the world that offers a bachelor's degree in automotive restoration. And the students that come out of there are ready to, you know, set the world on fire, restoring brass era cars and driving cross country and Model Ts and stuff. It's really a refreshing look at the hobby, and those are the people that are going to run our hobby when we're long gone.
I have been a big fan of McPherson College for a long time. I was talking to Jay Leno recently about McPherson and the tremendous contributions they're making, not just to the old car hobby, but providing a generation with the confidence and the skill sets needed to simply fix things.
Right. I love it. Yeah, right. Yeah, try to get your washing machine fixed, you know. And, you know, it's I'm ashamed to say that, you know, if you want to get your car fixed, now the car dealership has turned into like a doctor's office. And, if there's a warning light on in your car, well, it takes 2 weeks to get or 3 weeks or more to get an appointment, and then you're at $150 an hour saying, man, wow, these people didn't go to medical school.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, one of the things I wanted to ask you about too on your trip, Dots Pretzels, that seemed kind of important to you. And I'm sorry you got there when they were closed, but how did you develop an interest in Dots Pretzels? Because it's kind of a regional thing.
Well, it was regional. I'm up in Maine right now where a hurricane blew through yesterday, and which is why I'm sitting in a parking lot 7 miles from my house, because the phone service and the internet service is down. So so I'm up in Maine, and I went to a hardware store, and here's these bags of Dots Pretzels at Ace Hardware. And wow, you know what? I need screws and nuts and things, but I'll take a bag of those too. And it's like heroin. It's like Dots Pretzels. Once you, when you eat one, you eat the whole bag. So you're better off buying a small bag, because if you buy a large one, you know, you're going to have all sorts of issues, because it's a, you know, it's a lot of sodium and it's a lot of carbohydrates and stuff. But oh my God, I mean, there's not much more I'd rather have than a bag of Dots Pretzels and a cold beer to watch a, you know, a Formula One or a NASCAR race with. So, you know, Dots Pretzels has, they're made in North Dakota. Here I am in Maine. I tried them here. I've seen them in North Carolina. I've seen them around the country. And I said, I got to visit kind of the Vatican. If Dots Pretzels are a religion, then I got to go to the Vatican and meet the Pope, who would be Dot. But sadly, it was Memorial Day Monday. They were closed. In fact, I had heard that Dot had just recently sold the business to, some Snyder's Pretzels or one of those kind of people. So she probably made her billion and now she's going to retire somewhere. But, you know, name one thing in the world that's made in North Dakota. I can't. I don't know anything made in North Dakota.
No.
But here's here's a brand that put North Dakota on the map, so much so that I went, you know, 100 miles out of my way to go visit it.
Speaking of going out of your way, roadside attractions, the world's largest ball of twine. And I like the sign in your book, not just the world's largest ball of twine, but they had to make a note that it was sizzle twine.
Oh, yeah.
We got to differentiate between other balls of twine. Is that the idea?
I guess it's I don't know. But there it is. You can touch it. And, you know, it's living out in the open. You don't have to pay any money to see it. It's you know, all tongue in cheek. It's pretty wonderful, in fact. So I had to go there, and we decided to visit places like that if they were convenient.
Yes,
but wouldn't go terribly far out of our way to visit them, because sometimes, you know, you wind up right around the next corner, only 5 miles up the road. You know, another 15 feet, and you know it's 40 miles later. You finally get to a place, and it's not so good. So, you know, if it was in the way, on the way, we would stop there. And that ball of twine was on the way in Corcoranville, Kansas. So, pretty cool thing. And I can say now that I've seen the Mona Lisa and the largest ball of twine.
For us, my wife and I, it's been a running joke. Before we married, my wife had never really traveled much outside of Arizona. And I'd take her to the Redwoods, or I'd take her to different places, and she'd be amazed, talk about how beautiful it was. I says, yes, but you've never seen the world's largest hand-dug well. And
I have.
Yes, in Greensburg, Kansas.
Yep, when I drove my Cobra across the United States with Peter Egan from Road and Track Magazine, we were there, and, you know, I have a sticker on my suitcase on the back of the Cobra still, from that hand-dug well.
Have you seen, you know, what was ironic about this, it used to be just like that ball of twine. It used to be in the park and just open. And now they have built a massive million-dollar-plus complex over the top of the well.
Wow.
And it was funny because we were married 38 years, and we happened to find ourselves in Kansas. I'd been teasing her about this well for years, decades. And we show up in Kansas, and I get there 10 minutes after they closed. So she's still never seen the hand-dug well.
Oh, boy. Well, you know, yeah, so there's always something to look forward to.
Yes, yes.
So, you know, but when you get off the grid, so to speak, get off the interstate highways and drive across America on two-lane roads and go to little towns, you see what America's really like. And what I mean is, if you get on Interstate 40 to drive from, you know, North Carolina to Los Angeles, almost every exit is the same. Almost every exit has a Petco and an Applebee's and a Walmart and a Sam's Club and a, you know, this and that, and this and that. You could take that exit, a generic exit, and move it anywhere in the country, and it doesn't matter where you are because it's all the same stuff. But when you get off onto old main streets, sadly, so many of them have been put out of business because of Walmarts and that kind of thing. But, you know, there's a real effort in some towns to revive Main Street. And you've got coffee shops and microbreweries and craft eateries, bakeries and stuff. And that's the way those main streets started a long time ago. And so many of them are trying to get back into that. When you get off, that's what discovering America is all about. It's like not driving fast across the United States, driving slow across the United States and seeing things and meeting people.
Yeah, you get away from the generic. I think it was Charles Carroll who said the interstate made it possible to drive coast to coast and see absolutely nothing. To paraphrase, I believe that's what he said.
I love it.
Nolan Stoltz was with us this morning, and he mentioned your Dots pretzels. He says, heroin. My wife calls them crack pretzels.
Yeah. I get it. And, you know, my co-driver, my photographer, brilliant photographer, Michael Allen Ross, he had never had them. I said, okay. Well, so we, even though the factory was closed, went to a little grocery store, deli kind of thing, in right around the corner from the factory. And I bought a little bag of them. I said, here you go, buddy. and he opened them up and took a bite. And he looked at me and said, "F you, Cotter." And he said, "That's exactly it. This is crack. Thanks. You've just got me addicted now." So that was, so one more addict, okay? Turning America into God's addicts, one person at a time.
Yeah, I noticed that, of course, you have a great YouTube channel. And I'll post for everybody that's listening today, and when we publish this, I'll put up a link. Your barn finds, of course, were your initial, shall we say, claim to fame with in the publishing end of things. That's when I first was brought to your attention. You were first brought to my attention was your barn find books, because I think as kids, it begins with reading about the discovery of King Tut's tomb and searching for the lost Dutchman's mine, and then it becomes barn finds. And your book.
It's an adult way to go treasure hunting. Yes. Exactly.
And your stories about, finding these cars in your YouTube channel is pretty amazing. Pretty darned amazing. And it looks like you turned up.
I've got like almost 3 million subscribers to that. I didn't think there'd be any interest. I thought it was just my little personal passion. And my publisher said, "Hey, why don't you write a book about barn finds?" In fact, it wasn't even the term barn find was not even coined yet. I just, he said, "Why don't you write a book about discovering old cars?" I said, "I don't think anybody's interested in that. That's kind of my own thing." He said, "Well, if you'll write the book, I'll take a chance on it." And that was called The Cobra in the Barn. And, like 100,000 copies were sold, which is pretty amazing. It was available for 20 years. So in this new book, I like to write biographies on automotive personalities. I like to write books on barn finds, and I like to write the books on road trips. And on this new book, it was not about barn finds, but son of a gun, when you drive 8,881 miles diagonally across the United States through, British Columbia and Yukon Territory, and then all the way to the top of the Arctic Circle, and you see an interesting car here and there, you got to stop. So I had to, knock on doors and meet people. And, it doesn't matter where you live. You could live in Canada. You could live in Florida. If you're a car person, you're a car person. And everybody welcomed me with, a big smile. And so it's not about finding cars, but son of a gun, we found some cars anyway.
Oh, I know. One of the ones that really jumped out at me, you had a picture there. Real well done picture, the unique script on a 46 GMC truck. And that really struck a chord, because a 46 GMC is what I was driving when my wife and I were courting. And you see the Chevys, but the Jimmys are not something you see very often. They're pretty
cool. Yeah. And it was intriguing in Canada, where they, to save on tax money, save consumers on paying taxes, you couldn't buy a Ford truck in Canada. You bought a Mercury truck.
Really?
The Mercury truck had to have a certain amount of content built in Canada, and then it was considered a Canadian product, and it was much cheaper than getting an imported product. So trucks in Canada made by Ford Motor Company were Mercuries, and Dodge trucks were called Fargos. And and there was a few other things like that we learned along the way. Like, isn't that cool? So here's Detroit, and then there's Windsor, Canada, right across the river. And literally, from Detroit to Canada is probably a mile across the river, over a bridge, but there was a different brand of vehicle built in Canada than there was in Detroit.
I was aware of Mercury trucks in Fargo, but I didn't realize the reasoning behind it. Another thing I found interesting in your book, and kind of you managed to put a little humor on it, but that's kind of sad, is the changing in border crossings, how that's changed over the last few years. It's gotten a lot more complicated. When I was a child, we lived in Port Huron, Michigan, and we used to drive across the Blue Water Bridge for fish and chips at a restaurant, my dad's favorite restaurant in Sarnia. And it was just like, there was nothing to it. And now, of course, that's quite a bit different.
I think COVID, well, the 9/11 bombings, COVID, So, like, when you and I were going to Canada as young people, it was, you know, it was almost like another state. You just kind of waved at the guy, and the guy waved at you, yeah. and you were on. No passports required. But, you know, things have gotten in the way, terrorism and all that other stuff. So, you know, I guess rightly so, it's gotten a little bit stricter, but it's taken the innocence out of going from one country to another. It's like, oh, okay, really? I got to do this? So we had to apply for permits to drive over weeks in advance. And Michael, my photographer, because he had several thousand dollars worth of camera gear, he had to get a carnet, which meant he had to get permits to bring his equipment into the country with serial numbers and bills of sale, because when we left the country, they could say, hey, wait a minute, this equipment, you probably bought it in Canada if you don't have a carnet on it. And the cost, so the carnet cost us $600. But it would have cost him thousands in taxes and penalties if he tried to get him out of the country and we were caught. So, you know, pick your medicine, you know, $600 up front or thousands of dollars later.
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
How, as I imagine it's changed dramatically if you're taking a firearm across the border headed for Alaska.
Yeah, I don't know. We didn't have firearms. I brought bear spray. Thankfully, never needed it. I don't think you can bring firearms across the country or out of the country into Canada. But, you know, I wasn't even going to go in near that.
No. But I had a lot of friends for some reason, and some of the dry roasted nuts that I know down here in Arizona, they loved, used to, the old ranchers, they used to do a lot of hunting up in Alaska, my wife's family and others, and they would load their rifles up in their trucks, drive the Alcan and go to Alaska. But I don't imagine it's a thing anymore either.
Yeah. You know, one thing I can say about Alaska, you know, the Alaska Highway is that it was built in less than a year by the U.S. government, which is just amazing. Most of the Alaska Highway is in Canada. A smaller portion of it's actually in the United States, but it was built because of, you know, the Cold War, and that Russia had an easy access to get into the States by way of, you know, what they used to own, which is Alaska. So this Alaska Highway was built in less than a year, which is just amazing when you consider the mountain ranges and the rivers and the total wilderness and the cold that had to be dealt with. And then, so that was like, I think 1947, and if I'm not mistaken, 1952, and I'm going by memory now, it was open to the public. And so then, you know, if you could hook the Airstream behind your international pickup truck, and if you were adventurous type, go up, you know, up to Alaska. People built businesses along that road, gas stations, hotels, restaurants, but, you know, very sparsely. Like, we would go, you could go 50 miles without seeing a building, and then you come across a general store, and it might be open or it might be out of business. Sadly, the businesses that make it up there that are still open made it through the COVID. Now, if you remember when COVID hit, you couldn't go into Canada. So for a year and a half or so, maybe 2 years, you could not drive the Alaska Highway unless you were a trucker. Well, these businesses were built on tourism, and there was no tourism. And a lot of those businesses failed. So you'll see, you know, gas stations, restaurants, hotels that are just boarded up, and that's it. Through no fault of their own, it was COVID. But the ones that made it, they're doing well. Tourism is back. The truckers never stopped. And we went to places, you have never seen French toast or cinnamon rolls. A cinnamon roll as large as your head. Unbelievable at places. And, you know, the guy that owns the place, he and his son run it. They have their own bakery, their own restaurant, post office. He said, you know, we have to keep the truckers happy because they'll visit us every trip then. If we give them an impressive amount of food, we know we've got a customer for life. Man, whew. So, like, one order of French toast, Michael and I split it, and we still had more than we could eat. Pretty amazing. So it's a whole different scale there. You know, you go to a restaurant here, order French toast, and you get two or three little pieces of toast. Up there, they make their own loaves of bread, and they're huge. And then they dip them in the egg batter and all that stuff, and they fry them. Oh, my God. It's like, you know, the Jolly Green Giant eats here. Man.
I found that a lot of the rural communities, South Dakota, Kansas, Nebraska, they've suffered for years. You know, that's like you mentioned, the dying downtowns. And COVID seems to have really been a setback in so many of these towns for the attempts to revitalize Main Street historic districts.
Yeah.
It's just kind of a tragedy. I have to ask, you're from North Carolina, Davidson, North Carolina?
I've lived there, yeah. I mean, I'm originally from Long Island, New York, but I moved to North Carolina to get involved in NASCAR back in the mid-80s. Okay, yeah. And so I spent my professional career in motorsports.
Right. The reason I ask, I wasn't sure. Davidson was probably near Charlotte, but I wasn't too sure. Yep. I'm originally from Moorhead City, North Carolina, down on the coast.
Oh, isn't that funny? Yeah. Yeah. Huh.
Did you ever know Brad Bowling when you were working there at Charlotte?
I know Brad Bowling.
Yeah.
I know Brad Bowling well. I mean, Brad's a friend of mine. He now has his own publishing empire. Pretty cool.
Yeah, Brad's quite a guy. We go back. We've had an interesting 30-year-plus relationship where we work together for a while, and then somehow we lose track of each other for 5 years, and then I'm working for Brad again. I worked for him at Cars and Parts, Old Cars Weekly, and different publications. He's quite a fella, and he's such into bicycles now. Tom, I really appreciate you taking time to talk about this morning. Do you have a website where people can order like signed copies of your books or?
Well, I don't.
Okay.
But if people, if people want to get a signed copy, they can send me an email, and my email address is Tom Cotter. That's TOMCOTTER at CSX, CSX, like Charlie Sam X-ray. 2490.com. So okay. It's Tom Cotter at CSX2490.com. And you're probably saying, what the heck is a CSX2490? I'm lucky enough to own an original 289 Cobra, and that's the chassis number of the Cobra.
Ah, oh my, that good old that Cobra.
So I've got the books that I have. I've written now 17 books. But I have plenty of this new one, which is America's Greatest Road Trip. And I have plenty of Secrets of the Barn Find Hunter. And, you know, I hate to sound like a salesman, but, you know, if you have a car person in your life and you want to buy them a Christmas present, you know, I'll be glad to personalize it. So just send me an email and, you know, we'll take it from there.
Very good. I'll get all this information up when I publish this today. I'll have this up. I was going to ask if anybody had any questions. I see a few people typing away here. One of the you mentioned discoveries, and I hate to admit this, but sometimes I still let my schedule get in the way. I have to be somewhere for a presentation, speaking engagement, something of this nature, and then I'll meet somebody, and I hate to break the conversation short. And a few years ago, I was in Michigan, and I'm waiting for somebody. It looks like they're typing away here. But I was up out of Grass Lake, Michigan, near Jackson, Michigan, and I found this odd museum in this little town called the Lost Railways Museum. And there was apparently at the turn of the 20th century, there was this really extensive urban railroad network connecting all these small communities with the main line in Jackson, Michigan. And these gentlemen, retired gentlemen, had got together and decided to gather up all this old rail equipment that was being used as chicken coops and things, and they restored it. And I met the short version of a long story is that one of the head guys of this is an elderly gentleman, somewhere between 75 and 200 years old, Ken Soderbeck. And I canceled a couple appointments because he invited me out to his house, which I found out he never does. He lives on a place called Circus Farm out in the middle of nowhere. It was the headquarters for the Lewis Brothers Circus back in the teens. He converted the elephant barn into his home. And his claim to fame is he restores vintage fire equipment, horse-drawn and mechanical, before 1930. And his entire machine shop, I don't think he has any equipment in the shop that's newer than 1930. Just astounding. And he does it all. The wood spoke wheels. He does castings himself. He does the gold plating, the filigree, whatever needs to be done, he does it. And even more incredible, his shop truck that he pulls things in and out of the barn with is the only known surviving mid-teens Jackson four-wheel drive truck that he found in an abandoned wrecking yard and restored and made it into his shop truck.
Isn't that wonderful?
Those are the kind of people.
You know, you can't find that kind of person on an interstate highway exit. You got to get off the beaten path to meet that kind of personality.
You do, and you've got to meet these people and talk to them. Okay, I got a couple of questions here for you real quick. You were asking what kind of vehicle you used in this, and I mentioned the new Ford Bronco. How did that truck do for you?
Oh, man, really well. I had planned this trip for years, and I thought, maybe I'd drive my Woody up there. Maybe a friend of mine had a Shelby. Maybe we'd drive a Shelby. Model A Ford. Maybe I'll buy an interesting car in Miami on Facebook Marketplace and then sell it up in Fairbanks on Facebook Marketplace. And you're right about the trials and tribulations of driving an unknown car for 9,000 miles. But then I said, you know what? Maybe this book should not be about a vehicle. Let's take the vehicle out of the equation and make it about the people and the trip and mm-hmm. the scenery. And the experience. Yes. And so I got a hold of people I know at Ford Motor Company. And I said, I'd sure like to take your new Bronco on this trip. And they said, we don't need to sell any more Broncos. We're already got 3 years waiting list on those things. I said, what if I was able to get Airstream trailers? They said, well, that would make it pretty interesting. So then I went to Airstream Trailers and said, can you loan me a trailer? They said, well, we're 3 years backed up on trailer sales. I said, what if I could get Ford? And they said, oh, that would make it interesting. So it's the old Carroll Shelby trick. Hey, Ford, I got AC in my back pocket. Hey, AC, I got Ford in my back pocket. And so I did the same thing, and it worked for me, too. And it was really wonderful. And, the nice thing is I didn't have to own it. I didn't have to insure it. I didn't have to have it repaired. It was all brand new. So it was wonderful. The vehicle was terrific. I would own one in a second. I would drive the same vehicle to Alaska again. It was great.
Yeah, it was much as we enjoy the old cars, we have to be honest. The new stuff is as far as jump in it, turn the key and go. It's so much better than the old stuff, but it lacks a certain something. But it is nice, like you said, to have GPS and air conditioning and avoiding the roadside repairs in the mud hole it's kind of fun. Yeah. The new generation Airstream trailers, boy, those are exciting, aren't they?
It's called a base camp, and it was the largest. It was the only Airstream trailer that a Bronco was ready to tow. A Bronco is can tow 3,500 pounds, and that trailer was 2,800 plus our luggage and, fill the tanks with fuel and all that stuff. So it was the only trailer Airstream made that a Bronco could pull. And it was, I got to tell you, Michael and I are good friends, but it was a tight squeeze for two guys that are not romantically involved with each other. But we made it work. And it was, I would take that trailer and travel with Michael again anywhere in the world. It was great. So, everything was modern and new, but getting a trailer behind a Bronco, an Airstream behind a Bronco, was really a throwback to the old days, back to the 60s. And that felt pretty good.
I got another question here. Do you have any road trips planned or anything planned for the Route 66 Centennial?
No, I've already done. I've done a book on Route 66, yeah. And so that one's checked off my list. That's a good one, but I've already kind of done that. So I'm sure my publisher wouldn't consider another one. I'd love to go from Dead Horse Alaska down to the tip of South America, but I have to tell you, I'm afraid of Central America. I'm afraid of drug cartels and all kidnappings and all that stuff. So sadly, that is the ultimate road trip in North and South America, and I'm not going to take it.
No, I used to spend a lot of time down in Mexico during my John Wayne period, and I don't even feel comfortable along the border on this side anymore. I've got a friend of mine. There's a fine line between adventuresome and downright crazy. Her name is Anna. I cannot pronounce her last name. She's Ukrainian, and so they use every letter in the alphabet with very few vowels. An amazing woman. I met her actually in California, first time at Auto Books Aero Books, and introduced her to Jay Leno. We talked a bit, and we've privileged to host her several times. She spent almost 10 years solo traveling on a motorcycle. She did Fairbanks, Alaska, to the tip of South America. She's gone the tip of Africa, up through to Morocco and across the Sahara, Egypt, Iran, Syria, you name it, by herself solo on a motorcycle. And now she's parked her motorcycle and she's went home and joined the Ukrainian army.
She's
a pretty adventuresome woman.
This book, if you search for it in the front, you'll see that I've dedicated this book to the brave people of Ukraine.
Yeah, that's another story for another day, but that's a anyway, Anna, I'll send you a link. She's on Facebook. She has daily postings. And really fascinating woman. She combined her around-the-world trips. She got some funding from some Polish banks and some others, and then started working with the UN. She was doing educational programs in the most remote places to encourage people to read, to explore, to get out, to think bigger.
Yeah.
She was working with schools, all over the world. But Tom, God bless. Thank you for doing this morning. I've enjoyed this immensely. And you've inspired me. I've dreamed of an Alaska trip for a long time, and somehow I keep getting sidelined. And I got this harebrained thing. I've never had a Model A Ford. I've always wanted one. I've had tons of ancient things from 1915 Dodges, all the way up, but somehow I've missed Model A's, and eccentricity at my age might be an interesting thing. And I'm thinking a Model A Ford trip to Alaska might be interesting.
Model A's are reliable and parts are plentiful, and they are, again, affordable.
Yeah.
So, I'm all for it, man. Do it. I did it a Model T, and it was an amazing adventure.
Well, you did
one breakdown, 3,300 miles, not one breakdown.
You did the Lincoln Highway, wasn't it, with the Model T?
Yep. It's called Ford Model T Coast to Coast, a slow drive across a fast country.
Oh, I've got to find that one. I remember reading articles and hearing about your trip. The Model T is a great vehicle, but it's just a tad primitive. The Model A is a little bit better. A few years ago, I was very privileged to work with the Historic Vehicle Association when they recreated Edsel Ford's trip. They took the Model A, Model T, 1915 T model, and followed on Edsel's trip. And I got to tell you, we got that thing out into the deserts. I'd have to do some serious drinking to take my Jeep into some of the places that Model T went.
Oh, man, yeah, no kidding.
Across the Mojave Desert.
These new books, the past books, if any of your listeners are asking for my suggestion where they should buy a book, if you buy a book from Amazon, Jeff Bezos will never know about it. But if you go to your independent local bookstore and order it, the owner of the store will thank you, because it's so hard to make a living selling books. So if you're asking my opinion, go to your little independent bookstore in town and order the book, and it'll come in, you know, 5 days, and you'll make somebody's day by ordering it. So that's my hope for your listeners.
Well, this is one thing I always do when I travel. I try to call ahead of time bookstores on wherever I'm traveling, and I ask if they have any of my books in the store, and I'll always stop by and sign books. Just to make sure that, because supporting the local bookstores—it's such become such a rarity. I didn't mean to go so long for you, but it make you laugh a little bit. I had a little bookstore local; they've gone out of business now here in Kingman. And some years ago, I did a book signing, and it's become a running joke, kind of one of my taglines. But I did a book signing; it was surprisingly successful. They sold out of books. And I told the manager, I says, well, why don't we go ahead and pre-sell the books? Just keep taking them. I only live a mile from here. So when the books come in, I can stop in the store and sign them for the people.
Yep.
Well, I didn't hear anything from the store. And so I after a week, 10 days, I stopped in to check. The manager was on vacation and there was a lady there at the counter. And I could see the books on the pre-order shelf. I says, I go ahead and sign these for you. And she says, well, I have to have the manager's permission. We can't just have random people come in and deface books.
Oh, God.
So that's become a running joke that I will deface your book at no charge.
Oh, that's too much. Well, Jim, this has been a blast, man.
Thank you very, very much for taking time. Hope you get your electricity, all Wi-Fi, and everything back together. We're just not cut out to be modern Amish anymore, so we need these things.
Yep. All right. Well, you have a good day. Have a good week. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Tom.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye, sir. Guys, folks, we ran a little bit long this morning, but I really hope you enjoyed this program. We got to get to the business of Route 66 real quick. We will give a shout out to our good friends in Tucumcari, New Mexico, the Roadrunner Lodge specifically, an absolute living time capsule from the 1960s. If you get a chance, you're in Tucumcari, you got to try the Roadrunner Lodge. Talk to David Brenner. He'll take good care of you, and you won't regret that visit. We've also got to give a shout out to the Uranus Fudge Company near Lebanon, Missouri, where the juvenile humor runs supreme. And I'd sure like to hear your opinions and thoughts about our discussion today with Tom Cotter. And I'll get the information up about his book, America's Greatest Road Trip, Key West to Dead Horse, 9,000 miles across Backroads USA. I think you'll find it inspirational, not just from a road trip standpoint, but we live in an era of such divisive politics. It's amazing, the people, the commonality, what we have in common. This book is very, very impressive. And speaking of road trips, well, I'm headed east in a few weeks. I am the keynote speaker at the Miles of Possibility Conference in Bloomington, Illinois. I'll be speaking October 20th on the dawning of the great American road trip. I've been doing a lot of research for this, and I have come up with amazing stories. Some of them I'm going to share here in the future, but catch me on the road or schedule a presentation. I still have a little bit of wiggle room. I can sneak another program or two in on the schedule, possibly. Well, that takes us up to locking this thing up. I'll give a shout out to Connie Eccles, Cuba, Missouri. Wagon Wheel Motel, oldest continuously operated motel on Route 66. Been there since the 1930s. Hey, do we have any questions? Anything I can answer for you? Since we've run this up to almost an hour, I just want to ask, is there anything at all we can answer for you, talk about? Because if not, we're going to send this down the road. I'm still, can't tell you about next week because I don't know. I'm waiting for confirmation. But rest assured, we will be back next Sunday morning, 7 o'clock. Invite your friends. Let's make it a coffee party. And let's inspire some road trips. Let's share America's story. And speaking of road trips, well, how about some music from Woody and Joe? I always enjoy these visits. And as you can see, Tom is quite an interesting fellow. And America's greatest road trip, Key West to Dead Horse, 9,000 miles across Backroads, USA. Great book. Great book. Leanne, I hope you're doing well up in Oatman today. And Miss Maggie, I'm always glad to see you're with us. Nolan, how are you folks today? And Keith, gosh, we got us some great. The Hound has entered the studio. Well, very good. We'll have this published, and we'll have some information about Mr. Cotter. And we'll have that published probably in a few hours. And then we will also have it on our website, and it'll be on Spotify and other publishing platforms, podcast platforms, if you want to share this with your friends. My friends, until we meet again next week, well, adios, mi amigos. Take care.